Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Sadiqua Johnson, the author of Yellow Wife. This was the last book that I read during the holiday break, and I quickly noted it's a Book Reporter Bets On selection. As soon as I closed this book, I could not wait to start sharing it with our readers. In fact, I wrote about it in the January 8th newsletter as soon as we came back. I've been looking forward to talking to Sadiqua. It's like one of these conversations that I've been looking forward to because I have so many questions and to sharing it with all of you. So welcome.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Just lovely. So can you start telling us, because I love the story of where the kernel of the idea came for Yellow Wife.
So Yellow Wife, well, let's just back up a little bit that I was a contemporary fiction writer up until this point, right? So I have three other novels out. It was all contemporary women's fiction, a little bit of love, a little bit of romance, a little bit of family, drama. And then I am looking around for an idea for my fourth novel. My family and I had moved to the Richmond area in 2015. We had some friends come down from New Jersey in April of 2016. And we literally was just looking for an activity to get out of the house. We wanted to get the kids out of the house. We wanted to show the family around. We didn't know Richmond so well. So we decided to go on the Richmond Slave Trail. And the Richmond Slave Trail is along the James River. And there's 17 markers along the river marking different points with information about how the slaves were transported to Richmond and things that happened along those times. So the kids and I were walking and they're reading the different markers as we go. One of the children read the marker of the Lumpkins Jail. And the thing that really caught my attention right away was that the jail was a notorious punishing center for slaves. And it was also a trading post. And so it had a double duty. Mm-hmm. It was described as one of the most horrific places on earth. No, like that's not a place you would want to be. They described the smells and the torture and the things that happened to the slaves when they were there. The owner of the jail, his name was Robert Lumpkin. And it was said that he was married to an enslaved woman, Mary Lumpkin. And so that was the first thing that kind of got me thinking like, okay, honestly, my first thought was, could he be a Black man who mm-hmm. owned this slave jail? And the reason why was because in the 1800s, Blacks and whites couldn't marry. So my first thought was, because that's a little, a story that's not well known that Black people also owned slaves. So I thought that was my first thought. And then it said that they had had five children together and Mary had raised these kids. And while Robert Lumpkins was referred to as the bully trader because he was just that mean, it said that he loved his family. He loved Mary, he loved their children, and that he would do anything for them. So that contradiction was the other thing that just kind of got me going a little bit. I was thinking about what it was like for Mary. Did she love him? Was this a situation where she was just trying to survive? Like what was going on in her brain as she was living on this half acre? And also, what was it like raising those children? I mean, if you think about it, I'm a mother, I have three children. I can't imagine being in a circumstance where there's a jail with enslaved people, people are being tortured. You know, you're married to the person who is, you know, one of the traitors and also known as the bully. What is all of that like? And that was kind of the beginning of the hairs on my arm starting to stand up a little bit. And I started to pay a little bit more attention.
So it sounds like the story found you in a lot of ways. It's just, you're walking along like, oh, wait, what is happening here? You know, and I also, the half acre was the part that really surprised me as well, is that's not that much property to be
it's
right
not.
On top of where the jail is, everything to be right there. Like their family was really living the whole experience.
Yeah. And, you know, just to that point, that was the other thing is because I live on 3/4 acre. And when I look out of my backyard, I mean, besides the fact that it's way too many leaves for our family to deal with, that's the worst part about it. But it's not even that, it's still not that much space mm-hmm. for all of these different things to happen, for you to have privacy in your life. And, you know, for everything was overlapping. And that was the thing that I kept thinking, how is it for these children? How is it for this woman when this is constantly overlapping in their lives?
Yeah. So did you spend a lot of time walking that slave trail while you were researching and writing, or was that a one-time thing?
It was literally a one-time thing. We went, we walked the slave trail, and then it got to a point where the kids were getting kind of tired. So we couldn't finish the entire trail, but now my interest was piqued. So I needed to see the land where the Lumpkins jail was. So we get in the car, we drive to the end of the trail. We're on the parking lot where the jail was, and I'm just feeling this energy. Right next to where the jail used to be, there's also the African burial ground. And this was where they literally just dumped the bodies. There were no ceremonies. They waited until the dead bodies piled up. They threw them in the ground and they shoveled some dirt on them. And so this land is now a sacred area in Richmond. And as we were kind of like near the land, we walked to where the sacred area was. And it was this energy. I mean, you could feel this energy. It felt like the ancestors were waiting for me, waiting for us to come. You know, I felt the need at that point that this story was starting to become a part of my skin. The energy was such that the kids started dancing. The friend who I was with, you know, he started to pretend like he was playing the African drums. And it was almost a little bit ceremonious for us to feel that energy. And it was like kind of a homecoming. And it was after that I got in the car. I feel like that all that energy just got in the car and followed me home, because for the next few days, I just couldn't stop going online, Googling, researching, just trying to find everything that I could about Mary Lumpkin, the Lumpkins jail, Robert Lumpkin, and what that was like for them. So that was kind of the beginning. Even before I knew I was going to write Yellow Wife, it was the curiosity of this moment in history that I hadn't heard of, mm-hmm. and just wanting to know more about it. That really was where it started.
And you know, there are these little nuggets of historical history that we don't really talk about. We go to school, we learn all these facts. We learn this war, this, but we don't learn these personal stories that are so much the historical, that become the historical fiction that we all love. And then we understand so much more of what's going on. I always joke that if history was taught differently in school, if it was told with stories like this, everybody would have so much more of a recollection of it and have so much more feeling about it. Instead of, if this battle was here at this place, this many people were killed. No, it's like, what are the stories of the people? So Mary Lumpkin inspired Phoebe. So tell us more about Phoebe, because I just love this character.
Yeah, so Yellow Wife, the story is based on Phoebe Dolores Brown. Phoebe is a mulatto girl. The story opens when she's 17. And she's been promised freedom her entire life. She's the daughter of the master, with his favorite slave, Ruth, who is the medicine woman. And also she's the seamstress of the plantation. So she lives in the loom house. Phoebe lives in the loom house with her mother, but she's also favored and protected by the master's sister, who never married, never had children. And so she takes Phoebe on kind of as a prodigy. And so she teaches Phoebe to read, to write, arithmetic, history, and also to play piano. So Phoebe is kind of set aside from the other slaves on the plantation because of her training. Well, the master eventually marries a wife. And of course, the wife does not like Phoebe. Phoebe thinks that she is more than a slave, and she has a problem with her from day one. A series of events happen, and literally the rug is pulled from beneath Phoebe's feet. Her whole life changes in an instant. And she finds herself thrust into the Lapierre jail, where, very much like the Lumpkins jail, slaves are sold, tortured, and abused on this jail. And she really has to figure out how to survive, not only for herself, but also for her family.
Yeah, because it's a bigger issue than just what, again, we don't want to go into all the events because we're not going to spoil anything in this book, because there's so much that happens, and it just makes the story so much richer. So it's like we're tap dancing around, everybody, just so you know. But you described the plantation so well. So I want to stay there for a minute. I feel like I saw the plantation and the time that Phoebe was on that. I felt like I saw the loom house, the big house. Did you actually map it and draw and sketch what you thought each of those buildings would look like?
So what I did was, part of my research was that I visited plantations in Virginia. I have three children, but I grabbed my two daughters and I made them my research assistants. So I dragged them around Virginia to different plantations where we took pictures of the plantations. And I also did some research online. So what I would do was I would sort of map out the way the plantation looked. And this is the first book that I did this for. I have a wall near where I write, and I literally just put a collage up. And so I had the different houses, the house that, what the big house looked like, what the plantation looked like, what I thought the loom house would look like. And it was kind of like a world building that I did on this wall. So I used that a lot to sketch it. The other thing that happens is once I have the image of what these things look like in my brain, the moment I get into the writing and I get into the scene, I'm like zapped there. So it's almost like I drop down into a portal. And so I'm there. So much so, you know, my kids are virtual school. I was doing some edits on Yellow Wife a few months ago, and my daughter came in and I was so into 1850. Like I was so there. Like she literally, like I jumped out the chair. She scared me so bad because I wasn't, my body was here, but my mind was really on that plantation with Phoebe. So, you know, I get zapped into that portal and that's where all the magic happens.
You know, I could see that because when you're writing, the characters are so infused. And I know you have a drama background. Did that play anything into the way that you draw these very fleshed out characters? I mean, I felt like I saw all these people to the point where I was like, wait a second, there were no pictures in this book. How did I feel like I saw that so well? So yeah, is that what you do?
So I think my imagination, you know, being a lover of books, I've been reading forever, like ever. And I think being a lover of books, the images, they just kind of come to me like a movie. And so as I'm writing it, it's almost like the movie is like playing through my head. And, you know, I also write to music. So the music also helps to infuse the words, and it all just kind of comes together and flow. I take a lot of time with each character. I spend a lot of time doing character bios and really trying to get to know them. So much so that when I step away from my writing for a couple of days, I almost have to coax the characters back to me. So I normally would start with like writing on my journal page. When I hadn't seen Phoebe for a couple of days, I would just kind of write like, hey, Phoebe, like, how are you? Or what is it you want me to know today? You know, just little things to kind of get her back to talk to me again. So yeah, that's usually how my process goes.
And I love that Phoebe was born on Christmas Day. It made her feel even more special. And that little details like that make the character spark. So as you're reading, like, oh, her birthday's Christmas Day. So are those little things that were there at the beginning, or as the characters talk to you on second and third round, did those come in more?
The Christmas Day was the beginning. And it probably was a decision that I made based on the story opened in March. And I also have to figure out how I'm going to move time along. And so I knew I needed to get her off the plantation before Christmas. So that kind of helps me too with my place markers as I'm building the story along.
Yeah, there she go. And how did she come up with her name? Because I love it. It's just perfect.
I read the name Phoebe. I was visiting a plantation here in Virginia. I believe it was the Shirley Plantation. And they had a kitchen. They had the kitchen house still kind of intact. And on the walls, they had different slave ledgers and different things like that. And I remember looking at it and I read the name Phoebe. And that was the beginning of me trying to pick names of actual slaves. And so most of the story, all of the names in the book are names that I either found on slave ledgers. Mm. I learned about them at the plantations, or my cousin actually did a family tree for us. And she was able to take our family all the way back to the 1700s. And so I also went into that and I would pick names from there because my thought was I'm telling one story, but I also wanted to honor as many ancestors as possible and give a voice to those who didn't have a voice as much as I could.
Yeah. And, you know, and also there were house slaves and field slaves. There was like a hierarchy on the plantation as well. So can you delve into that a little bit? Because it was definitely like the people come out of the fields and they didn't have as good a life as Phoebe and the people in that big house.
Yeah.
As great as their lives were not. So can you share a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, they had just a little bit more power because they were either working in the big house or they lived in the big house. So I separated the plantation, Hightown and Lowtown. So Hightown would be all of the sub houses of the big house. So Phoebe lived in the Loom house and there was the stables. And so anyone who worked on those in those homes, they had a little bit more power. They had a little bit more access to food and clean water and clothing. And if you want to call it a little bit more privilege, I mean, I think in being enslaved, there are really no privileges, but they had just a little bit more. Whereas the slaves who lived in the fields, they usually suffered from different types of diseases and being cold. They slept on dirt floors. You know, they had threadbare blankets, their clothing. They had less access to food. And so whenever there was a gathering where those from the high town and the low town got together, the high town always looked out for the low town. So they would make sure that they wouldn't eat at the gathering because they could always get food from somewhere else, but they always tried to feed the ones in Lowtown. And that was the way I was able to kind of create, there's a hierarchy everywhere. I mean, even in our homes, you know, the mom and dad's in charge and the kids, you know, and there's the oldest. And so it was very important for me to show that on the plantation.
Yeah, and I felt that, Phoebe and her mother had more privileges than most. And was there love between her mother and the master, or was that purely a sexual relationship?
I believe that it was circumstantial. I do believe that Phoebe's mother's name was Ruth. I do believe that her main goal was always to get her daughter out of slavery. And so she was the sacrificial lamb. So whatever she had to do for and with the master, she would do it in order to get Phoebe free.
Yeah. So Sally, who you alluded to before, who was the sister of the master, she loved Phoebe, took her under her wing, and it was unlawful actually to teach slaves to read. Like everything that she was doing, she was empowered to do, but that normally wouldn't happen. So opportunity actually makes the difference between surviving and dying. It's like along the way. And Phoebe and her mom had those. For Phoebe, much came from the mixed race heritage, but even that didn't save her. In the end, it like didn't save her. She was still owned. And I think that was interesting because even though she had privilege, there was still that line and she still couldn't cross it. And I felt like every day for these people was exhausting about survival. It was about getting through the day. It wasn't about enjoying life. It was getting through the day. And you did such a good job of showing all the obstacles that could come up with even just being in the big house and having the lush job. So did you always take steps to ensure that the characters were on that edge? Because no one ever really got comfortable.
Yeah, that was a line that I had to toe. And it was difficult sometimes because sometimes I would forget, you know? And so that's also where good editing comes in, Carol, because I have really good people around me who always will like, even if I start to veer too far right, they'll bring me right back to the center. So just towing that line of she had a little bit, but she didn't. She had a little bit, but she didn't. The moment you thought she was okay, then she wasn't again. And I felt like that probably is what makes it good fiction. And that's what makes it such a page turner. At least that's what I've heard from other people who've read it. They can't put it down. And that's why, because the moment you think you got it figured out, you know, I throw something else in there to take it in a completely different direction.
Yeah. And I just say, oh, okay. So everything's really nice on the plantation until it's not, you know? You see people are trapped in their world. And the one thing we're looking at, slave women whose bodies were conscripted by white men, did so not at their own choosing. It was not because, oh, I want to get ahead in life. It was really either for their children or it was just a circumstance. Mixed race children were challenged as to which world they'd be in. Like Phoebe always wants to go, her freedom, she wants out. Was passing something that was discussed even then at that point? Or were these women seen as traitors? Like what was happening at this time?
A lot of the mulatto women that I researched, and not all of them, but I talk a little bit about the fancy girls in the story. And that was a profession that was specifically for mulatto women. It was mostly women who worked in a brothel. So they were bought by a master, and the master would have a business and he would basically have somewhat of a brothel, and these women were used for sex. So that was one profession that mulatto women found themselves, you know, again, not with their permission, but that's what they found themselves. Another thing was that in the Richmond area, what I found was men like Reuben LaPierre, which is based off of Robert Lumpkins, men who were traitors and who owned jails, such as the jail that I discuss in the story, those men were looked at as the pariahs of the neighborhoods. So no white man would marry his prized daughter to a man who traded and dealt in slaves, even though everyone had one. It was kind of that hush-hush business, you know? And so they couldn't get a good wife. So they also married and had children and started a family with mulatto women. And so it wasn't just Phoebe and Reuben LaPierre in my story, but there were many stories like that that I was able to find as I was doing my research. And so I think at one point in the story, Karina Hinton is one of Phoebe's friends. And she said, you know, this is kind of the best that we can do. This is the best that we could hope for mm-hmm. as mulatto women.
So she's promised freedom at 18. She's promised that she's going to be able, did that actually happen? I mean, we read so many stories of people waiting for their freedom. Did that actually happen? Were there slave owners that said, okay, it's 18, you can go off on your own, move up north?
It depends. I think I probably came across one or two stories. A lot of times it was an empty promise. Mm-hmm. And the cook says, you know, something to the effect that, you know, promises coming from the master, it ain't but dust or something, she said, yeah. Because it was something that they heard often, but it was not always a fulfilled promise.
Yeah, because we read about that a lot of times in the book, that everybody's waiting to get their freedom, get their papers. And it just never seems that there are very many people that that would happen for. It was.
And also too, because it was a business. So even if the slave was related to the master, why would he just give up $500, $600, $700, $800, which was equivalent to, you know, thousands of dollars. So if he let, even if it was his child, if he let that go, he was also letting money go. And mm-hmm. so it was few and far in between. It did happen, but I would think the promise of it happened way more often than the freedom of it.
You know, and I was thinking of Britt Bennett's book, The Vanishing Half, because it's like later years. This is what ended up happening in later years after slavery. This is what, and I just was all like, you know, peeking in my mind as I was reading, because it was like, wait a second, then later on, what ends up happening with this whole generation of people who go on? What happens to everyone from there? You know, there's so many tough scenes, and I found myself wanting to look away, but I didn't, because Phoebe's World kept me reading. And I honestly couldn't put it down. And I feel like there's a real balancing act going on in storytelling like that. There's a lot of drama from the character's point of view, that there is humor too. My favorite line was Mrs. Delfina saying, "Running this plantation has robbed me of my beauty." I mean, what a great line. And this woman is so self-consumed that she doesn't even realize everything that's going around her. It's all about her. And mm-hmm. it was, there are just so many moments like that throughout the book that I was just there like, dead on writing, just really well done.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I really enjoyed, speaking of Mrs. Delfina, I really enjoyed writing her. I had to do some very specific research on what it was like for white women, because we look, you know, it's the full story, right? So we're definitely in Phoebe's world and dealing with what she's going through. But each character has to have a beginning, middle, and end. Each character, you have to have some sort of sympathy for them. You have to feel each character. And so the research I did was like, what was it like for white women who lived on this plantation, on those plantations? It was isolating, you know, and so it was very important for me to show that she felt isolated. You know, she's the only white woman on the plantation. There's no one for her to talk to. There's no one for her to, you know, communicate with who can understand what she was going through. And she still wanted to be beautiful, and she wanted her husband to love her. Things that we all as women, you know, we go through. And so it was important for me to make her three-dimensional, even though she's the bad guy to some degree. She still needed to be fully developed and full and a full person.
Well, she still hears her husband is leaving with the other woman. Like, and he says, "I'm going to go on and I'm taking her with you." And she doesn't have a choice in the whole thing. In a lot of ways, she's trapped as well, but she doesn't realize she's trapped. She's just putting on makeup and putting on her beautiful dresses. They change all day long too, which is the thing that constantly kills me, is these people just change their outfits all day long to go down to breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So
yeah, to walk the plantation. She had a different dress to walk the plantation, a different, you know, yeah. And it was all consuming for women like Mrs. Delfina.
Yeah. But then when the parts are hard, when the writing is hard, do you write and then you can get up from your chair and immediately go back into, I mean, you were saying before, if your daughter came in, I was like, oh, you know, yeah. Why are you here? Do you find it tough to finish writing these scenes and then go back to real life or go back to your life?
So there are a lot of really difficult scenes in the book. And like you, when you said you didn't turn away from them, I appreciated that because for me as the writer, I felt like it was important for me not to shy away from it. Like I had to write it the way it happened because it happened. And I think we owe it to those people mm-hmm. who have gone through this to understand really what happened. So it was important for me to show it the way it happened. When I was writing some of those difficult scenes, some of the whipping scenes and things like that happened in the story, really what happens when I finish my writing, just in general, I have to have a little bit of separation. And so I normally write in the mornings and I always work out kind of in that afternoon because mm-hmm. the running, like I'll go for a run, I'll put some music on, you know, I'll do something, I'll go in the kitchen, I'll cook something. Like I need to kind of pull myself out of that space and that mind frame. I need something to ground me, to ground my energy and bring me kind of back here. So I always have to have a little bit of separation. I can't like jump off the computer and, you know, and then I'm off to the next thing. Like I need some kind of some grounding space.
Yeah. And it's also to get yourself out of their heads and get back into the real world heads because you could see how much you were really in your characters' heads and that's one of the reasons I think the story moves so seamlessly because you were really feeling with them. And I loved when you were saying before that, you know, sit down, Phoebe, talk to me, tell me what's going on. You really felt that was the vibe that was going on with your writing. Is it hard to leave the characters behind? Was it hard to say, okay, it's the end?
So when I get to the end, I am often relieved. I spent 3 years, give or take, with these characters. And in this world, I mean, I was like on the beach reading The Incident and Life of a Slave Girl, you know, where people were reading, you know, a good beachy, fluffy story. So I spent a lot of time in that world. And so when it was the last period and it was off, it was a celebration for sure.
Yeah. It's like, okay, I've been there. I've done that. Where's light and frothy and bring it on, you know?
But I do think about them. I mean, I'm working on my fifth novel now and I was kind of working with a character and I accidentally wrote the name Phoebe down. So she's still right there. She's still right there. I was in the kitchen the other day and I was thinking something and then Phoebe popped in my mind. So she's right there, but we've made peace we've made peace with the distance now where we are, you know, in this next phase of our lives together. So, but she's right there.
She's right there. But you don't sit there and say to children, Phoebe.
Yeah, no. No, it's the next character that I have to remember. No, her name's not Phoebe. No, this is not about Phoebe. No, that's what Phoebe would say, you know? So that's how Phoebe would say it, but that's not how this next character would say it. So I just have to kind of self-correct.
Yeah, like Phoebe is not cleaning your room. You're cleaning your room. You know? Yeah. Like what's going on? Is there more reading for people to do? Like any reference titles? Do you have them on your website? Because I felt like your research was so strong on this. Have you, I know they're in the back of the book, but is there any other place that you've shared all the titles?
No, and that's actually a really good idea. I guess I could include that on my website, but they are all in my author's note at the back of the book for now.
Yeah, because I just thought that would be so much, you know, fun to do. Okay, so your sister looked into your family's history. Was that tough going to sit there and say, wait, was it parallels to what had happened? Or what did you find that were little nuggets?
So it was basically names and places that I was able to find through my cousin's research. It was basically, well, I moved here to Virginia, just kind of on a whim. And it's funny because a lot of our ancestors lived in Virginia on both sides of my family. So it wasn't really a whim, it might've been a calling. You know, it was just little things like that. Oh, I only live about 30 minutes from, you know, where these ancestors, where it says that they were buried. You know, little things like that is what I found. Unfortunately, it wasn't like deep stories or narratives about their lives, but mostly it was just their names and their date of birth and the place that they lived.
Oh, so not like, you know, huge backgrounds on them as well.
Right. Yeah.
And it's sometimes strange. Like you'll just see they live for 2 years and you're like, well, wait, what was the story? What did they die from? What happened? When we've done any looking back in family history, it's always interesting to say, well, who were these people? Like there were, you know, and you just never came across them. I haven't read your other books, but I've heard you talk about them. And so a lot of those books were infused with love and like, you know, great romance. And I feel that many ways this book is a book about love because it's about the love of mother to her daughter and the love of a daughter for another man in her life and then love for her children. Do you love writing about love?
I love writing about love, Carol. I mean, love makes the world go round. And I remember when I got into a point where I was a little bit stuck on Yellow Wife and I called one of my writing mentors and she said to me, she said, Sadiqua, you're not writing about slavery. She said, slavery is just the background. You're writing about love. You're writing about family. You're writing about connection. Don't lose sight of that. And that was really the click in my brain that changed everything. Because I think in the beginning, because it is such a tough period in our history, I was bogged down with the responsibility of writing the slave story. And she said, it's not the slave story. It's a love story. It's a family. It's a survival story. That's just your background. And when I was able to make that little change in my brain, things started to flow for me.
Yeah. And you know, it's little things like her mother caressing her hair, her mother braiding her hair, just all these little things, her grabbing her mother's dress, all these little moments that are just connectors of people. So love is besides what you say to each other, it's what you show to each other. And that's what I felt it was in this book. There were little gestures that someone would give someone a little bit of extra food or they would do something. And it is not just romantic love. It's love of sharing your life or sharing what's happening. And that's what I saw coming off the pages as well. Am I on target?
Yeah, you're right. You're right on target. So I'm glad I did my job, Carol.
So, okay. I heard that it took 3 years to write this book. And I heard that you did something really unique is you retyped the book along the way. Yes. And I love that you did this. So, but just tell us why you did it. Because I think that we don't hear a lot about this. We hear people correcting or whatever, but you just went back to square one. So tell us about that.
So my writing process, and it's been my process pretty much through all four novels. My writing process is that after I do the first draft, and it's a terrible draft, really, it's just hacking through the woods, getting the story down on page, having something so I have some sort of roadmap for draft two. I print it out, I sit on my couch, I get my red pen, I make notes in the margin for myself. I open up a new Word document on my computer and I just start retyping the whole thing over. And I don't just like go the whole way. Like I'll type the first chapter. I'll look at that first chapter. I go back, I edit it, I fix it, I make it what I think it should be. And then I go back and type chapter two. And for me, what happens is that I get to re-envision the story. So I re-envision the story. It goes through my body again. I reconnect with those characters in that setting and that place again on a deeper level. And I also weed out the things that I don't need. Because when you retype, you find that you're a little bit lazier the second time. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to just retype stuff that you don't think you need. And so it's also part of the editing process for me in that retyping. And so I do that maybe 2 to 3 drafts. I'll retype it. For my first book, Love in a Carry-On Bag, I think I retyped it 6 times. I think 6 drafts I retyped it. And then as I went along and I had an agent involved and the editor involved, I didn't have as many times to retype it because once they get involved, then they're putting edits in the margin and the line, you know, the line edits and it just makes it a little bit more difficult. So before I get to that phase and it's just me and the work, I retype it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because one of the reasons I read it as the last book was I had like a day left and it was a slim book. And I really love that this was a book that it was 272 pages because a lot of books I feel these days are bloated and there's too much in it and it doesn't need it. And you could just pull this out and move the story along. And what I felt here is that the tight prose really was what made me love the book all the more because I was floating through it as opposed to, okay, all right, I'm there. It was every single, like, I felt like every single paragraph and page was moving a story along and you don't see that all the time. So whatever you did along the way, just know I did end up seeing it. Yeah. paid off.
Thank you for that. That's always my goal when I'm writing a book, because I'm actually a hard audience to write for, just me personally, because I agree with you. I don't want to read a bloated story. I also want to be doing, I want to be learning while I'm reading. Mm-hmm. So I need to be learning something about craft. So I need to learn about craft. I need to be entertained, and the story needs to move along quickly. And so a lot of times when people have asked me, like, who's your audience? Who are you writing for? And the real answer is, I'm writing for me. You know, I'm writing the book that I want to pick up and devour and read and a couple of, you know, sittings. And I want to be thinking about it when I walk away from it, you know, like that. So I'm writing for me and any other reader who's like me.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what I was seeing. And it definitely worked. And a lot of times people say, oh, I wrote really tight. And I'm like, that's not tight. That's not that tight. I'm not going to spoil the ending for readers, but it was so satisfying. It wraps so well. And there's so much love once again in those pages and news. And I pictured readers of those letters reading them and smiling and do their own version of a fist bump to each other about like where lives have ended up, seeing life on the other side. Am I right that you wanted people to feel like, okay, everybody, let's do a little exhale here?
So I also feel like now books don't end. I don't know if this has been your feeling about some books. It's like you get to the end of a book, but you don't have any sort of satisfaction that things happen. And I understand that you don't want things neatly tied up in a bow. Like that's like the old way of writing, you know, years ago. But I felt like there has to be some sort of middle ground. So I like to be satisfied again at the end of the book. And I've read several where that's not the case. So it was important for me to give my reader something. I'm not sure that I want to write a sequel. That comes up a lot. I kind of need a break from this period in history, but I wanted to give my reader enough that if I decide that I never write a sequel, you've got what you came for. You got your money for your book, you know, and you leave satisfied.
But I also feel like it wasn't one of those speed up to the ends. Like sometimes in the last 10 pages, it's like, oh, wow. Well, that was about five chapters that could have been spread out and, you know, consolidate the others. I felt like it was perfectly paced there as well. And that's an art as well, to be able to sit there and wrap it and feel like you were satisfied, but there's a lot of depth in those last pages. But I felt like I had a great experience. And I went back and reread those last night, in fact, because I said, I just want to see like where the story ended up and where it's shaped. So bravo to you, you know.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
So you've talked a lot about history repeating itself. And right now there's a huge hue and cry for more Black voices to be heard. And it's something we've heard in publishing before. Are you confident this time that the voices are going to continue to be heard?
You know, it's my hope, and it's a prayer and a dream, because I know how difficult it was for me to get published. Mm-hmm. You know, my first book, Love in a Carry-On Bag, came out in 2012. And when I went to the publishing houses with an agent with a background in publishing, I still was not able to get a publishing deal, you know? And so I see so much change, but I just hope the change sticks, you know, because there's so many beautiful voices, you know, BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, people of color. It's so huge, all these different ways that we can tell a story. And I think in order for us to embrace the difference in each of us, we need to be able to read these different stories. So my hope is that this wave will continue and that it's not a phase, you know, because things happen in waves, things happen in cycles, and then they forget, then they come back, then they forget. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that this time it'll actually really stick.
You know, and over the last few weeks, I've been watching Bridgerton, and you're going to sound like, oh my gosh, like, you know, Carol, trite and funny compared to my like very serious, very well done book. Yeah, I get it. But what I really thought watching this, how different the world would be right now if the races were equal. Because as I was watching Black and white characters with no talk of race, there was no talk of that going on. I thought, what if the world had been like that back then and been through to today? How different would the world be? And reading your book, I was reflecting on that as well, because if there wasn't this, who's a slave, who's this, there's not different hierarchies of people, what would the world have been like? And I just have to give you that as a little takeaway, because when I was watching the show, yes, it's a complete, you know, romance fantasy, let's get real. But by the same token, seeing everybody intermingling without talking about race or culture like that was very, very interesting to me.
Well, that's Shonda Rhimes at her best. I mean, she is a master storyteller and she does it, you know, she's top of her game. I haven't seen it yet. My daughter did. And she, you know, she said it's amazing. So I have to make some time to like, I'm not a good vegger, Carol. That really is what I'm not. I'm a busybody. So being able to kind of sit and like binge watch, I can do maybe two shows. And by the third show, I'm starting to get a little itchy, but I'm going to make time for it because the Globe and Mail newspaper in Canada compared Yellow Wife to Bridgerton. So so there, well, I have to see it now.
Well, I'll teach you my trick. I never just watch. I either watch and knit or I watch and do email. And then every once in a while, so my biggest button on the control is rewind because I've missed like some whole thing. And I'm like, wait, where are they? Like, wait, what's going on? Because I'm always doing two things. And it's either I'm dropping stitches or I'm like answering like a really in-depth email. And I'm like, wait, where did they get to the countryside? Like, how did they get there? But it's either that or I just can't sit there and vacuously watch TV. Though it, over the holidays, I did have a couple of moments where it was 3 a.m. and I was watching Virgin River. I will confess that I was like, what am I doing? And I was like, I think I'm really just trying to get my head to another like place. And that's all I'm doing. So I don't know. That was like my big takeaway. Are your three children, is anybody old enough to read the story?
So I have a 17-year-old son who I am pressuring. You know, my kids are not that impressed with me, Carol. I mean, I don't know what that's about, but they are not impressed by me. So I've been pestering my son. He said that he would try and get to it over his summer vacation because I make them read through the summer. So he was like, Mom, just put it on my summer reading list. My 15-year-old daughter, I think, is ready for the story, but she, you know, she's all caught up in the Vampire Diaries and, you know, that's her world right now. So we'll see how it goes. And my 12-year-old, I think she's still a little bit young.
Yeah. Isn't that funny though? It's like, wait, Mom, you're all that? No, you're really not. Yeah. What's for dinner?
You know exactly. What I mean? Exactly.
And who's driving me where and what's going to end up happening? Well, how do they feel about their day trip having inspired the book? Do they realize that's like, wait, where are we going to go next, Mom? You know?
Yeah, they, you know, they were a little bit younger when we took the plantation tour. So they were a little bit more excited to help me. You know, the older they get, the more jaded they become. So when I tell that story, you know, I get like a little sly grin, like, yeah, I was there, but they're not that impressed by me.
See, but this is what happens. If you had live events right now, they could be in the audience and go, wow, look at all these people think my mom's pretty cool. Maybe I should change my attitude here and read the book.
and that's the way it was for the last book. Like they would come to live events and they sat in the audience and actually they would even ask questions. So if it got quiet and no one was asking a question, one of them would raise their hand and ask really good questions. And I didn't even plant the questions, I have to be honest. And I was always like, okay, good job. You're paying attention.
But this time you're just upstairs.
In my office, it's no big deal. But I will say the youngest one does help me with my lighting. So I did give them jobs. If I give them jobs, they're a little bit more connected. So the youngest one helps with the lighting and the middle one, she'll help with the makeup. So that's how I keep them connected.
So we should do hair and makeup credits at the end and lighting credits to them. Okay. I feel like that should just roll on the credits at the end. We'll see if we can work on that. So you started your career in children's publishing and I don't know if it was a big book you worked on. What was it? Three books by J.K. Rowling. I mean, seriously. So what was that like? And what did it mean? Like, what did it teach you? What did you take away from her? That when you said, when I'm an author someday, this is my thing that I want to still do.
Yeah, that was an amazing experience actually, because I worked on, just working on the first Harry Potter book, feeling the energy of the publishing house, wanting it to be something big. And it just wasn't just yet. And the moment it broke, I remember that it was NPR that broke the story. And that was the beginning of the snowball effect of the Harry Potter that we know today. And it was like, it was magical to be a part of that movement. Not to mention that J.K. Rowling is the sweetest, nicest author ever. I mean, she was always so humble. She was always so kind. Even after, so I worked on the first three books and then I was kind of reassigned. But when the fourth and the fifth book came out and I was no longer working on the books, she always sent me an autographed copy. She would always say something like, hey, Sadiqa, sorry I didn't get to see you this time. I mean, she was just so pleasant and humble. So what it taught me was that my time is definitely coming, that I just have to stay the course keep the momentum going, and the story will break.
There you go. And I think you should get her a copy of the book. I think that you should sign one now and send it to her.
Even think of that, Carol. That's such a great idea.
I think you should just say, just put your little special touch on that and get a book to her. Because yeah. I bet that she's the type of person that she'd say, wow, that is, yeah, I think it's a moment. I think it's a moment. Yeah. That could go on your to-do list. So then you went on and you worked at the adult publisher over at Putnam. How did your role as a publicist influence now what you think about when you go out to promote your book?
It has influenced me greatly. When Second House from the Corner came out, that was my second novel. My old manager, director of publicity, she gave me a call and she said to me, she said, Sadiqua, don't ever forget that you are your biggest advocate. Mm-hmm. And I took that to say, you know, you are in a publishing house, you do have a team, but never forget that no one loves this book more than you do. So you need to get out and do the work. You got to do the work. And that really shaped, you know, who I am as an author. I think Simon & Schuster really likes working with me because I'm a collaborator. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't just sit and they tell me what to do. I bring energy. I bring information. I bring sources to the conversations. And we work together as a team in promoting this book. I'm not just waiting for them to tell me what to do. We're working together. And it's a gift to have the background and to know kind of what needs to be done in order to push this book to bestseller.
And also to know that it's a certain period of time that they can actually work on your book. And then they're on to, like, there's cycles. And I think that people just need to know that there's like this 8 week or 12 or 3 month period that everybody's focusing on you. And then after that, you've got to keep the momentum going yourself. And you see that and you're realistic, because I think a lot of times authors just really don't understand. It's not going to be my moment forever.
Yeah. And that's totally, it's so funny because my husband and I have been talking about that, because now that the book is actually out, I do feel like my time of being, you know, the center of their universe is probably starting to wind down. So what's part two? What's mm-hmm. part two for us? What am I going to be working on? Kathleen Grisham is a friend and a mentor who wrote The Kitchen House. And she said to me, she was like, for that first year after The Kitchen House, she said, I was really my own publicist. I booked everything. I showed up. I did everything people asked me to do. She was like, that is why the book was successful, because I put 100% of my energy into it. And so mm-hmm. I know that that's what I have to do for Yellow Wife. Mm-hmm. I am still trying to write a fifth novel. It has been very difficult. I would say probably the last, well, since the book came out, it's been difficult because my brain is splitting. I was talking to Julia Kelly. She and I had a conversation and she said, if you just write 1 to 2 hours a day, that'll just keep the momentum going. Then you'll feel good. And I have to say, Carol, I'm struggling with the 1 to 2 hours a day, but it'll come. It always does.
All you're going to do is when you have that 1 to 2 hours, you can go, Phoebe, talk to me. And you're going to say, whoever the new character is, you're going to go, talk to me. And I think you need to allow yourself these couple of weeks of what's going on, these few weeks of probably like 4 to 6 weeks of just like, you know, nonstop talking about Yellow Wife. But I also think that there's going to be something else that happens, because I think this book would make for a fabulous book group discussion. And I think that you're going to get groups like that want to reach out to you. How can they get in touch with you if they want to have chats with you? Can you, do you have time to do chats with them?
Oh, and absolutely. Right now I would say that my calendar is booked through April with book clubs that have reached out. I absolutely love speaking to book clubs. They always bring a different energy and flavor and direction to the story. They see things that I've done that I didn't even know I did. And that's always just so wonderful to hear. So the best way to get in contact with me is I have a website, which is SadiquaJohnson.net. So you can go to my website. You can find everything you need to find about me. I do Facebook Lives, of course, Instagram Lives. I'm also part of Novel Network. So if your book club is a part of Novel Network, you can go through Novel Network to book me and I'll come and talk to your book club.
Right. And when you come to the book club, do you want to come? And I always say this, do you want to be there at the beginning? Or do you want them to discuss the book a little and then bring you on? What have you found that really works the best? Because sometimes everybody shows up, they want you there and they're still talking about like what their kids did that day, you know?
I always allow for 15 minutes. So I say, if your book club meets at 6 o'clock, I'll come at 6:15. So that gives them time to say, hey, Shirley, you know, what you making for dinner? You know, all of those little chit chatty things that they need to do. So when I show up at 6:15, we can really like get down to the business of the book. And it usually works well if there's like kind of one person who's kind of the moderator. So maybe they've all given her the questions and or him the questions and, you know, they ask or they're, you know, someone's monitoring the chat or, you know, that is usually a good, like kind of how you and I are talking. Mm-hmm. I find that that creates a really robust discussion when we do it that way.
Yeah. So that there's some, this going back and forth of what to do. Also, if you're in a book group and you go to book her, this is really important. Tell her what time zone you live in because you will be surprised. We've been doing these Book of Chino live events and my Zoom will open up like an hour later. So-and-so's in the room. And I'm like, they're in central time, you know, here we go mountain. And it literally happens. So do make sure you like share that kind of information as well. Was Yellow Wife always the title of the book or did that something that came up along the way?
Yeah, Yellow Wife was always the title. And I'll tell you how I found it. I was doing some research online actually. So it's not anything that I read, but I found some portion of a copy of Robert Lumpkin's will. And in the will, it said, I leave all of my real estate and my fortune or my money to my yellow wife. And he meant Mary Lumpkin. And then he left something else to his black concubine, because of course he had more than one woman. And so I thought, huh, yellow wife, that's an interesting way to describe her. And so I wrote it down. I made it the title, but I'm always very flexible. So all of my titles have stuck, believe it or not. Wow. The title that I come up with, they have all stuck. And I said, if my editor or my agent thinks that this is not a marketable title, I'm fine with changing it. But they loved it. And so it stayed the whole way through.
No, it completely works. Was this always the cover? Because I just love the cover. You notice I wore yellow today, work with your cover.
Yeah. Yes, well, thank you. The cover we went through, I'm very fortunate that my publishing house brought me in on the cover. Even from the very beginning, they asked me like, what was I thinking when I was reading the book, when I was writing the book, was there any images that I had? So we kind of talked it out and we went through four different rounds of jackets. So this was on the last round. And what I was able to add to this beautiful cover was, if you look in the skirt of her dress, you kind of see, you see Richmond in the background. Well, that is Richmond. So that's a city in the background. So this is kind of like old timey Richmond, the 1800s. So I was able to add that into the background because I thought that was kind of important. It kind of ground the book in the place. And I also love that sewing machine kind of in the background because she worked at the loom house and she was a seamstress. So those were the things that I was able to add, but I think they did a great job with the textures and the colors and everything.
And the key, like right across the middle.
And the key was also too, because she keeps a journal throughout the story. She keeps a diary. And so I wanted to kind of be like the lock and key, but also the jail, you know, that also symbolizes locking up the jail. So it has a lot of symbolism in it.
And I do like the little typewriter in your background for your symbolism right now. Huh? It did not go unnoticed by me at all. Just figure, you know, she just typed down a few lines, whatever, you know? So last night, I also listened to a track of the audiobook, which is narrated by Robin Miles. Did you have a hand in selecting her to narrate it?
So she narrated Second House from the Corner as well. And when we were working on the narrators, the salesperson asked me if I liked Robin Miles. I think he asked me if I liked her or would I want to use her. And I was like, absolutely. She did the first book. And that was just a quick email and it was done. So I was glad she was available because I've heard really good things so far about the audio. I've only listened to the intro, which I thought the first page that she read was really good. So yeah. I don't normally listen to the audio of my own books. You won't even believe this, Carol. I literally just start listening to audiobooks like a week ago. Okay. I'm such a reader that I don't read on Kindle. I still read an actual book. Like I'm so old school, but I'm like, Sadiqua, you gotta like pick it up a little bit. So I started listening to my first audiobook and I'm enjoying it.
Well, you know what it is? Sometimes I can get more done if I can listen to audio. When I used to drive into the city, we live in New Jersey. When I used to drive into the city, there was a long time in the car. Yes. And there were times where we were through many, many discs on the way in the car. And yeah, what I find is it's a different kind of experience. And it made me think about, I know you typed your book a few times. Did you ever read it out loud for cadence? Because audio is so big. You can tell.
Yeah. I always read it out loud. And the reason why is because if I'm tripping over the words, then I know that it's too many words. I have to take something out. So mm-hmm. I always read it out loud. Usually when I'm doing a draft, that's when I know that that chapter is finished. So I'll write it, I'll fix it, I'll edit it. I'll read the chapter out loud. If it's, I call it singing, right? So like if the chapter is singing back to me, then I know I can move on to the next chapter. But yes, I always read them out loud.
Yeah. And it you could tell because the pacing and the voice really works like that, because they're not, I think that's the reason you have 273 pages and not 369, because you know that it's like, okay, let's get this down. Those are extra words. What would I actually say? So for your next book, can we have a little hint of what the time frame is going to be?
Sure. So the book that I'm working on now, I'm going to still work in historical fiction. I think I've been bitten by the historical fiction bug. I really, really enjoyed writing Yellow Wife. And so I think I'm going to stick with that, but I'm not going to go as far back into our history. So right now, this novel is shaping up to be in the 1950s. It's a cross between, it takes place in Philadelphia. I grew up in Philadelphia. So it takes place in Philadelphia, and it also takes place in Washington, D.C. It's another story about strong women and what they have to overcome. And it's the first time in a few books that I'm going to tell the story in two voices. So pray for me. It's a little bit more difficult than I thought. I feel challenged, but I think you need to be challenged on every book. So it's going to be told from two different points of view. And so that's kind of where I am, but it'll be, you know, full of all the things that you've come to expect from a Sadiqua Johnson novel for sure.
It's going to be love. There's going to be love in there as well, for sure.
You already know.
For the research, being 1955, do you think the research is going to be easier or harder? Simply because when you go back, you have like one lens on what's going on. And here you have so many more people's opinions and a different lens attached to the people still alive to interview.
So I will say that when I was researching Yellow Wife, I actually had to leave the house and go out and find the information. So far, and I'm only on the second draft, so it doesn't mean that I'm not going to do it, but with COVID, I can't really go to Philadelphia and poke around the way I want to. So far, I've been able to do most of my research kind of online and reading articles and that sort of thing. And I think it being 1955 versus 1850 does make it a little bit easier, but there are some things that I just can't find. So I know I'm eventually going to have to go out and feel it, feel the energy, you know, drive through the neighborhoods and go to the library, or maybe even go to the Philadelphia Inquirer and get some of the old, you know, newspapers and that sort of thing to really put me in that people, places, things sort of feeling that I need in order to tell the story.
Yeah, because it's like what they're eating, what they're doing. It's all that period that you have to get right, that you have to nail right. And this time people will actually know. For 1865, there's nobody around. Hey, she's got a little wrong. They didn't really eat that. It's okay. You know, we can let her slide. We don't know any better. Well, I look forward to seeing what you write next. I feel like I should go back and read three other books. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad you are staying with historical fiction, because I think you've got a real knack for writing it. So congratulations on a book well done. Readers, you're in for a real treat with this one. I think you're going to really enjoy it. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure to be here with you today.
And to our readers, we look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Yellow Wife by Sadiqua Johnson, narrated by Robin Miles, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. Thanks to our research assistant, Catherine Custer. And now, listen to an audio excerpt from Yellow Wife, narrated by Robin Miles.
Mama believed that the full moon was the most fertile night of the month, and that everything she touched held God's power. Each full moon, she dragged me out in the middle of the night with her to hunt for roots, plants, seedlings, and rare blossoms to use for healing. I did not understand why God's power could not be found during daylight hours, and as I trudged behind her, the March cold overwhelmed me. Even my thick wool shawl was no match against the country freeze. Fear of the woods made my feet clumsy, and I tripped over fallen sticks, scratched my shins on the spiky brush, and bumped my head on low-hanging branches. Mama, on the other hand, moved with skill and confidence. Like the earth parted a path and presented the way for her. Even in the dark, she knew where to stop for herbs and how to avoid the dangerous ones. We had only a small lantern to guide us, and when I asked how she knew where things grew, she responded, "My gut be my light." We slipped through the thicket, past the drafty cabins where the field hands slept on pallets stuffed with hay and husk. I heard dry coughs and a low whine from a hungry baby. Farther down toward the James River, we traveled through the clearing where we met on Sundays for church. Then, over the hill, along the side of the cemetery, peppered with sticks to honor our dead. As we traveled deeper into the woods of the plantation, the thick forest blocked the light of the moon. I could hear the growls and grunts of unseen animals, and fretted over running into hungry raccoons or red foxes or stepping on a poisonous snake. I tried to clear the worry from my mind as the land flattened out, but then something pricked my ankle. Before I could call out, Mama stopped suddenly and reached for my hand. "This here is a black walnut tree. Grow deep in the woods, so you gotta know where to look. Cure for most everything. Ever unsure, come seek this tree." Mama handed me the lantern, then pulled a blade from her satchel and severed a piece of bark. She brought it to her nose, then ran her tongue along the inside of it. "Husk stain anything it touch. After we make a tea for Rachel, rest we use to dye those sheets for the nursery. Just hoping we ain't too late to save that girl." Mama reached into her bag and pulled out a red ribbon. "Go on and mark it, so be easy to find when you come without me." I reached up and tied the ribbon on a skinny twig, knowing I had no intention of roaming these woods without my mama. We stopped at the sick house on our way back home. That morning, Rachel, the house servant, had been moved from the big house to the sick room on account of her high fever. Even though Master Jacob's wife, Mrs. Delphina, knew Mama worked plants better than anybody, she refused to bring her up to the house to tend to Rachel when she got fevered with lockjaw. Rachel grew up on Mrs. Delphina's family's plantation and came with her to Master Jacob's as a wedding gift from her mother. Since Mrs. Delphina looked down on Mama's medicine, she called in a white doctor for Rachel, which Mama said was a waste of good money. He ain't know nothing about doctoring no field hands. And Mama was right. Now that the white medicine had failed, Mrs. Delphina had no choice but to move Rachel to the sick house. When we entered the room, even I could look at Rachel's pale body and see death coming for her. "You ready the hot water?" Mama asked the sick nurse, who nodded her head and pointed to the boiling pot. Mama reached into her sack and pulled out the bark and leaves from the black walnut tree. Then she pinched off a sprig of snake root and crushed up the stems. "Let it steep for about an hour. Then make her sip every time she open her eyes. If she make it through the night, there'll be hope." Mama removed a few balms and poultices from her medicine satchel for the other patients, then gently pressed Rachel's forehead with the palm of her hand and whispered, "Lord, look on Rachel with eyes of mercy. Restore her to wholeness and strength. Thy will be done."